Hello, hope everyone is doing well. Welcome back to another episode of the Football Per 90 podcast. Today we have a really, really fun episode. We're going to be discussing things such as Xavi's Barcelona, and we're also excited to say that we're bringing on our very first guest ever, Steven Ganavas, to help us discuss the current title race going on in the Serie A. But before all of that, we're going to firstly discuss some very interesting group dynamics going on in the Champions League this week. We have four groups we're going to talk about: Group B, F, G, and E. Aaron, if you want to start us off with Group B and the permutations, I would love to hear what the possibilities are for the teams and their results.
Yeah, sure. So in this group, Liverpool have already won, but any of the other three teams, Milan, Porto, and Atleti, can advance. If Porto win, they're through in second against Atleti. If they draw against Atleti and Milan don't beat Liverpool, they're still in second. If Porto draw or lose and Milan win, then Milan's through. And if Porto lose and Atletico win, then Atletico go through in second. So a lot of interesting combinations here. I'm curious to hear what you guys think will happen in the end.
Yeah, Alex, do you want to start with your predictions?
So I think I'm going to break it into the two matches. And we've got Liverpool hosting Milan, who need to win. Liverpool are through. And then we've got Porto hosting Atleti. So I think I'm going to be a bit boring with this, as much as I actually really, really do want Milan to go through, because it's exciting. I really like their team and I want to see them back in the Champions League. I think Liverpool aren't really the side to sort of take it, you know, take their foot off the gas in games that don't matter anymore. They might do a bit of rotation, but I still think they'll have a lot of top players there. It's at Anfield. And I do think they have the sort of players that will give Milan trouble. Milan also don't have Kier anymore. He's injured for the next 3 months longer. So yeah, I think I'm going to be boring, and I think it's going to be an Anfield win. And then otherwise, yeah. So I know you guys were speaking earlier when we were speaking about this, but Atleti haven't had a great season. I still think I see them kind of pulling something out of the bag against Porto. But yeah, I'm a little bit less sure with that one. I haven't watched too much of those sides this season, but I think I'm going to be a bit boring and say that Atleti do something and pull through. So yeah, let me say number one, Liverpool, number two, Atleti. And yeah, I don't know where that leaves Milan and Porto.
All good. And Aaron, what about you?
Yeah, I'm going to keep it the same there. Alex made some good points. I think Atleti are just, they're made for this competition, and I back them to get a one-off win to get where they need to be, especially against, I don't think Porto's a European heavyweight, that tend to be the ones who are able to hold Atleti off. So I'm going to go with Atleti second, joining Liverpool in the knockout stages.
Yeah, I think I'm in the same boat as well. I think Liverpool, even if they do decide to rotate, will probably be pretty overpowering regardless. So I think that Milan will unfortunately not go through. I'm kind of with you as well, Alex, on Atletico. I do think, like a lot of the additions they had this summer, I love Rodrigo De Paul. I think he's a great player. Love Llorente. I like that they added Griezmann back too, and I'm a huge João Félix fan. So I'm hopeful they go through regardless, because I love to see Atletico Madrid in the Champions League. So I'm going to stick with Liverpool going first and Atletico Madrid getting second. So I want to move on then to Group F. Aaron, again, if you want to start us off, we know this is your favorite group, clearly. So if you want to walk us through what the what the possibilities are for this group.
Yeah, so Manchester United somehow won this group after five games, despite losing the opener to Young Boys. And Young Boys are eliminated because they're 3 points behind Villarreal and behind them on head-to-head. So United go to Young Boys again, and Villarreal are playing Atalanta for the second spot in the knockout stages here. A win for Atalanta is the only case where they can go through. A draw or win for Villarreal seals the deal. So pretty much a prediction for that game and who you guys think is going through in second.
Yeah, Alex, do you want to talk about your predictions first?
Yeah, sure. So I think I'm just going to speak about the match that's in the balance. And it's what, Atalanta hosting Villarreal, right? Yeah, so I haven't watched that much of Atalanta. From the stats and from what I've heard, they're pretty much the same as they've been the last couple of years. But I don't know why. Something tells me... I have watched Villarreal this season. Something just tells me that I think Emery has the capacity to pull a win out here. I don't know exactly why. I think for all of his faults, and as an Arsenal fan, there are many that we can speak about, and he has the propensity to be leading a match and then throw it away with some cowardly sort of, I don't know, cock-a-lans on for whoever's. But yeah, I do think he has a good ability to sort of prepare for big matches like these, especially as more of a plucky underdog against very attacking teams. And I think with guys like Danjuma, they can really hit Atalanta at the back. Chukwueze too. So yeah, I think, I don't know, like, I could be very wrong and this could end up being some like 3-4-0 to Atalanta, but I think I'm gonna go with Emery's Villarreal here.
And Aaron, what about you?
I'm gonna go the other way. I'm gonna go for Atalanta. They've made the knockout stages 2 years in a row and been a pretty good force in them. Having seen both teams in both ties as well, and against United as well as kind of other times throughout the season, I felt that Villarreal are, first of all, they're performing really poorly in La Liga. They're 13th with, I think, 16 points from 15 games, which is really poor. And then I would also say that they were poor in both the United ties, and that United were really bad and they had the chance to kind of take both of those games and they just didn't really grab the game and put it over the line. And Atalanta have a really strong attack. Their metrics have dropped off just a little bit this season. We'll be discussing them a bit later. And yeah, I think I back Atalanta to be able to grab enough goals to take advantage of the fact that Villarreal aren't really firing in front of goal right now. And it's not bad news for Emery because he gets to go back to his favorite competition, which is the Europa League, and go for his, what is it, fifth Europa League title now. But yeah, I'm gonna pick Atalanta and disagree with Alex there.
Now I feel dumb for forgetting to think that maybe he wants to go into the Europa League, but yeah, we'll see.
Well, actually, Alex, I'm going to be kind of agreeing with you here. I don't think Emery's going to go back to the Europa League. I actually think Villarreal is going to win. Now, don't get me wrong. I think I like a lot of the players on Villarreal, but I think I like watching Atalanta more. But I do think on paper, the kind of team Villarreal is, hitting teams on the break, it suits playing against a team like Atalanta a lot better, because they do have the tendency to leave themselves open in the back. I do understand, Aaron, though, that Villarreal has struggled from positions of strength, namely against Manchester United. I don't think they took advantage of those fixtures. But I think Atalanta is kind of, you know, has done the same as well. But Atalanta play a completely different style. They play more high risk, high reward. So I think as a result, that's going to tip in the favor of Villarreal. And they're going to, I think they're going to get the job done against Atalanta even away. So I'm going to move on then to Group G. But I know this is a really complicated group in terms of all the different kind of potential results from it. So, Aaron, again, if you want to walk us through what you have for explaining Group G.
Yeah, so in order we have Lille, Salzburg, Sevilla, and Wolfsburg on 8, 7, 6, and 5 points. So any of these four teams can go through. Wolfsburg are hosting Lille in the final game, and Salzburg and Sevilla. So basically, if Wolfsburg beat Lille, that's their only chance of going through. Same with Sevilla, they have to beat Salzburg. For Lille, they just have to not lose, and they're going to the knockout stages. And then for Salzburg, they can't lose. A win seals the deal, but a draw could also put them through if Wolfsburg fail to beat Lille. So a lot of interesting kind of permutations there. If you guys just give me a prediction for both games, and from there, we'll basically be able to determine who you guys think will be going through to the knockout stages.
Yeah, sorry, I had to check my phone to actually kind of visualize how that group's standing right now. But yeah, I feel like this is going to... I hate being called it, but I feel like this is going to out me as a hipster, but I really do want both Wolfsburg and Salzburg to kind of go through. So let's go through both matches. It's Wolfsburg are hosting Lille, if I'm right. Yep. And yeah, I mean, I think what we can see here is that both have kind of changed, well, have changed coaches over the summer. And then in the case of Wolfsburg, once again, changed it during the season already. Yeah, and I think, I know that they're both not as nearly as high as they were, but And I've yet to see Wolfsburg, for clarification, under Kofeld yet. But I don't know. What I have seen of Lille under Govanek, I've really, really not been that impressed. I don't know why they're at the top of the group table. But, I mean, it's clearly they haven't been dominating the table. It's 8, 7, 6, and 5. So, yeah, I think what I'm going to go for is I am going to go for a Wolfsburg win against Lille. Also, they've had some really, really good players that I've heard of coming through. For example, Mecha is my guy. I've liked him since I saw him at Anderlecht. And yeah, I think they're the sort of team that can kind of beat Lille out. And then, yeah, moving on to Salzburg versus Sevilla. So I feel like I might be the odd guy out here. But maybe this is a bit hopeful, but I think I'm going to go for a Salzburg win and be a bit positive. I really like what they've done under Yassel. I hope I pronounced that right. And yeah, I like Adeyemi. I like their midfield a lot. I do think they defend pretty well, given how attacking they are. And I know Sevilla are one of the best teams and are very well suited to playing attacking sides. But yeah, I think I'm just going to...
So essentially you think Salzburg's going to beat Sevilla because you like Salzburg?
Pretty much, yeah. Let's go for that.
Well, okay, I'm going to go... it's okay. I think my logic is going to be kind of similar here. Because I
it's
am
my
going
time
to
allowed
pick...
to be non-analytical.
I'm gonna pick.
Go on, Aaron.
So in the first game here, I'm gonna pick Lille. I'll be honest. I haven't really seen any of Lille or Wolfsburg this season, but I know Jonathan David is a baller, and he's the best player in Ligue 1. He's better than Messi, Neymar, and Mbappe. He's the top scorer in the league, and. Yeah, I'm not biased at all on saying that, but I think he's going to be the one to fire them to the knockout stages here. They just need a draw, ultimately. And, I mean, even if they lose, they could still possibly go through here if Salzburg... Actually, no, they can't go through with a loss. But if they... wait. Even if they lose here, I think they can still go through because if Salzburg and Sevilla draw, they would still go through. So I'm backing Lille to go through, and I think they'll do it with the result. And then on the other side, yeah, I'm going to disagree with Alex again. I really like Sevilla. I think they're a really well-drilled team, and I like the way they play both on and off the ball. I like the core of players that they have. Their center-back partnership of Diego Carlos and Koundé is really well-balanced, and both players have been linked to some of the biggest clubs in Europe over the last few seasons, and it shows in their defensive record in La Liga and their standing in second of the table. And then in front of them, they've got more strong players, like their midfield. I really like Jean Jordan. I don't think he gets enough recognition. I've seen he started to be floating around. I believe it's Spain's international setup, so it's good to see him there, and it's fully deserved. And then up front, they've got a couple of interesting strikers who I think will also fire them through. So, yeah, I mean, Salzburg's an interesting young team, but I'm backing Sevilla to join Lille in the knockout stages. I got Lille in first and Sevilla in second.
Okay, and for the sake of time, I think I'm just going to say that I agree with Aaron. I'll be very brief as much as I can. I think Sevilla have been very good in the La Liga. Their defensive record is, I believe, joint first. I love Salzburg and a lot of their players. But when speaking with Alex as well, in what he had mentioned, that I think, you know, them being well-equipped to handle attacking sides are going to work in their favor. I just can't see Sevilla going out here. So I think they're for sure going through. Wolfsburg and Lille,
just
I'm not really too sure.
Faith in Adeyemi. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay, I love Adeyemi, but I don't have no faith in him. It's just the team as a whole. It's a team game. Anyways, but with Wolfsburg and Lille, neither of them have been doing well. Wolfsburg do have a new manager. Lille did from the beginning of the season. I'm not really sure. I do think, though, since they're in a position of power, just holding on to a draw might be enough. And I do like a lot of players on Lille, specifically Jonathan David, as Aaron said. I'm a big fan of his as well. I love Renato Sanchez, too. But, yeah, so I'm going to run with Lille and Sevilla. And I think Lille actually would then be – Lille getting a draw. And I think they'd actually be first because they have the head-to-head against Sevilla. Yeah. So, finally, I'm going to move on to Group E, which has some pretty funny narratives as well. So, Aaron, if you can, you want to start with Group E.
Yeah, so you might have noticed that we put Group E last despite it coming before F and G in the alphabet, and that's because we have Barcelona in this group, and they could be eliminated from the Champions League. I know, Barcelona aren't the team they used to be, and we're going to be discussing that in detail later, but they come up against Bayern Munich, and they pretty much need a win to confirm going to the knockout stages. They're on 7 points, and Benfica are playing Dynamo Kiev, and they're third with 5. So a draw for Barca. Benfica is head-to-head after beating them 3-0 in the first leg. So a draw for Barca and a win for Benfica would put Benfica through. A loss for Barca and a win for Benfica would put Benfica through. And only a win for Barca can confirm that they'll advance here. And they're playing a really strong Bayern Munich side. So I'm interested to hear what you think on this one, Alex.
Sorry, did you say me?
Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
Oh, okay, cool. So, sorry, I blanked. Let's just take the time thing, and then we'll go 15:23. Cool. That's what I did for the at earlier. Sorry, I blanked. I was getting lots of messages, so I was just trying to turn it on to silent, so that I didn't have to... 15 minutes.
Don't worry. Yeah, what am I supposed to say? Bayern versus Barca and Benfica versus Dynamo Kiev.
Benfica versus?
Dynamo Kiev.
Benfica versus Kiev.
Okay, at home. Yeah, and Benfica are second at the moment, right?
Benfica are at home.
With 7.
Benfica's home, Bayern's home.
Cool. All right. 3, 2, 1, go. So I think I'll just put the Benfica and Kiev match out of the way. Kiev haven't been that good. I think Benfica will probably win it. I don't know what that means. Would that mean they're definitely through? Probably would. Maybe it's a draw. I'm not sure. I think the more interesting match, and obviously what we're going to be speaking about more, is the Barca-Bayern side. And I think I'm going to avoid saying too much because I have a lot of notes for when we get to that section. But I do think from what my impressions are that Bayern will win this most likely, pretty much. I think Barca could kind of suffer against them, to be honest. Maybe they rotate a lot. I'm not sure what to expect, but I still think Barca could Bayern rotate, not Barca. But yeah, I think it could be painful for them from what I've seen of Xavi's Barca so far. But yeah, we'll get to that next section. So let me say, yeah, Benfica second, and maybe Xavi takes Barca far into the Europa League. They can be the new Villarreal.
Okay, and what about you, Aaron?
Yeah, I'm sure every Barca fan hearing that they're the new Villarreal are going to love our podcast, but I'm actually going to go with the same thing here. Bayern are steamrolling teams. Like, their metrics in the Bundesliga are unbelievable. They've had 3 losses in the last 8, but before that were pretty much completely invincible. I think they're a really good team, and they're going to rotate because they have a perfect record right now, but I still think their rotated side is probably enough to get past Barca, or at least get a draw. And if they get a draw and Benfica don't manage to get through against Kiev, they'll regret that for forever, I think, especially if they don't make it into the Europa League after that. So, yeah, I'm going to go with Bayern first, Benfica second.
So, if Barca win, no matter what they're through, they're in second, even if Benfica win, because Barca will be on 10 points, Benfica will be on 8, so even if both win. But I, similar to Liverpool, but maybe even more in this extent, I can't imagine Bayern being at home. Bayern just seem like the team that just enjoy embarrassing other teams, like, honestly. So I think they just take pride in it and stuff. So I think, like, especially Lewandowski now, you know, not winning the Ballon d'Or, I think he just wants to steamroll anything Messi-related, even if, you know, he's not on Barca anymore. So I do think Bayern's going to... Sorry?
It's the small guy from Poland.
Yeah. No, I do think Bayern's gonna beat Barcelona. I think Benfica will beat Kiev as well, and just for that reason, with Bayern just most likely taking the W there, I think it's gonna be Bayern first, Benfica second. So I think that kind of does it for our Champions League section. Next up, we're gonna be discussing Xavi's Barcelona. So please stay tuned for that. Thanks. Hello, and welcome back to the Football Per 90 podcast. We're now going to be discussing, in this section, Xavi's Barcelona. Alex, I wanted to come to you first and just kind of get your thoughts. What do you think about Xavi's Barcelona so far? What do you like from what you've seen of them?
So I think I'm just going to start off I kind of watched all of their matches in preparation for this segment, and I think I'll start off with their first game against Espanyol. And what stood out immediately to me is just how tactically clear they were already from literally the first minute of his first game. Not saying that necessarily tactically expert, like highly proficient or anything, but just very, very clear the sort of things that he wants to get going. For example, basically, I think anyone would have kind of expected from Xavi a classic sort of 4-3-3, inverted wingers, lots of patient but quick sort of circulation. Particularly, I think what's kind of interesting is if you kind of look at, you know, the old Barcelona clips from like 2011, 2010, where you'd see like Xavi, Busquets and Iniesta all like doing those little triangles just around the field. You kind of see that with Nico and Gavi and Frankie and Busquets still. So yeah, that immediately stood out. Otherwise, I really liked how tactically good they are. Out of possession, I think what immediately stands out is how structured it is, both in terms of, again, basic man-to-man sort of marking system, high pressing game, strong counter pressing, and I think what we'll get into it, but there are definitely lots of problems at the moment, but I was very impressed by just how clear everything is from minute one.
Well, I actually wanted to ask you, because you mentioned Busquets, and Busquets, I think, has been a really interesting talking point, because I think a lot of people were thinking his time might be done at Barcelona, but then, particularly in the Benfica game, I think, like, the way kind of Xavi's team has structured him, where he's dropping a little bit deeper sometimes, even between the two center backs, he almost seemed kind of revitalized, and it almost protected his kind of deficiencies to cover ground as much. Have you noticed the same kind of thing? What are your thoughts on Busquets? Do you think he can last in this system?
So I'd actually have to defer to you about whether he's been revitalized, because I didn't watch much of Koeman's Barca over the last year or so. But what I will say is that he's a lot better than I was expecting, considering what I've kind of heard. He still looks like the Busquets of Odin in possession, especially with how Xavi kind of has them playing through the middle. He's the main guy kind of sending those balls right through the middle, nice vertical balls that kind of disrupt the opposition defense and allow Xavi's teams to kind of do that final sort of combinations in the final third. I think defensively, he is kind of a weak point just by this complete lack of mobility and how high Xavi wants them playing. So, yeah, it's kind of an awkward point where he's really, really important to them in possession and what Xavi wants them to do in possession, but he's kind of a liability out of possession. Overall, though, I still think he's a big plus, in my opinion. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with that. So, I mean, I think in possession, like, some of the passes he makes and sees, it's that, like, vintage Busquets where you just, like, you haven't even seen the pass and it's already there. And you just, you're kind of like, wow. And the play has continued and you're still thinking about, like, whoa, how did Busquets do that? But I think time will tell whether he's kind of viable in this system, in this team at the highest level, because the midfield units that you're seeing across top teams in Europe are all extremely mobile, high-pressing, and have good ability on the ball. And part of the battle that we're seeing is you have to have the ball, and you have to have the ball in good areas and be able to control the game before that level of influence and possession can kind of be what it is, right? And we know he has that influence of possession, but whether Barca will continue to be able to kind of have a stronghold on games and stop the opponent from transitioning, I think they've had some issues with defending transitions that we've seen so far. I think we'll probably get onto that at some point, but it's interesting to see whether he gets that. And like, I mean, moving forward, they've got a couple players who I think they've used well to protect him, but they're gonna, I think, need more, and we'll get more information about that in the future.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I mean, all of those points make a whole lot of sense, because I think in possession, it's quite obvious. Busquets might still be the best player in his position when he's on the ball. I mean, you know, Alex, you mentioned Koeman's Barcelona and stuff. And yeah, like from the times I'd watched, I mean, just generally speaking, Barcelona over the past year have been quite susceptible to those transitional chances they concede. And that's really been killer for them. And having a guy like Busquets who's supposed to be screening but has a lack of mobility to cover that ground is not necessarily, you know, kind of the best outlet to be able to mitigate those kinds of risks. So, yeah, I mean, I think the only way to go about it, really, because he does add so much in possession, especially if Barcelona will... I think it's contingent on whether Barcelona's press will allow them to remain as a possession-dominant team, because, as you mentioned, Aaron, we'll go on to it a little bit, but I don't think their press has been all too impressive right now. And but if the press allows them to retain possession better, to keep guys like Busquets on the ball rather than off it, or they kind of balance it out through the midfield kind of trio they make with him, because I do think there's a few players with some crazy mobility that can maybe protect him a little more. I'm honestly mostly worried about Piqué, because once they're playing a higher line, I think Piqué also, with Busquets as well in the same team, is really where it could be problematic. Piqué, I don't think even in his prime, was the best at covering, you know, recovering and stuff in space against athletic guys. He would struggle sometimes. But I think with those two necessarily in the same team is where it could become problematic. I personally think would opt for replacing Piqué and then keeping Busquets if I was to choose between the two. Because I do think, like, what they do in possession, especially with the way they try to progress the ball, I think they have those combo plays through the center. And Busquets is really good for that in those tight positions, those compact central areas of build-up play. And then they have these big switches out wide, and they have these combos then in the final third with their fullbacks and their inverted wingers, Alex, as you were mentioning. So I think a lot of that stuff means Busquets can be very integral to that play, and it might be a tougher task to replace him than someone like Piqué. So I'm not exactly sure, you know, what's going to kind of give earlier, but I think we'll see. So we were talking about some of the players in their team. I wanted to kind of get into some of the guys that I think are really suit Xavi's style a little bit more. Are there any guys that kind of stick out to you, Aaron, that you want to talk about, young or old, right now, really?
Yeah, I mean, the first one is Gavi. I think you have this kind of sense of... I mean, I think Barca fans who are listening to this might almost take it for granted, but every player who comes out of La Masia, or at least a lot of them, seem to have this positional sense in possession that is just so sought after at the highest level that I don't often see with academy players coming out of other teams. And I think Gavi's a great example of that. So under Xavi, he's played in a number of different positions, mainly on the left wing in a 4-3-3, but also on the left of the front three of a 3-4-3. And he has this really nice connection with Jordi Alba, where he's able to go high and wide when he needs to be available on the wing to stretch the pitch. But then he can also come inside and make these nice combination plays with Alba. And then I also think he's a very much a throwback midfielder in possession. Hasn't really shown that like expansive passing range yet, but I'm sure he has the ability to do it in the long run. But he loves those short, quick interchanges, really nice ball carrier with that low center of gravity. There are times when you look at his physicality and you're like, he's tiny, but he'll come out of a group of three men and win the foul or get out and keep possession. And then, you know, when he performs a 1-2, he's really good at looking up, makes really nice decisions in and around the penalty area. I remember there was one play against, I think it might have been Benfica, where Longley is playing left center back and in a back three, and he goes and he makes a run. And then Jordi Alba's out wide, and Gavi actually sees that and senses it and withdraws his position to become available for the back pass, and then receives and continues to circulate the ball. Just little things that I think kind of represent how Xavi will look to play for his Barca side, and things that I think that they'll look forward to, and he'll continue to grow. And then even statistically, he's performing in the higher bracket on a lot of possession metrics. It's kind of skewed because he's played a number of different positions, but there's a solid group of stats: progressive passes, pass completion, pressures, tackles, progressive carries, and dribbles. Like, across the board, he's just performing above average at a La Liga and a European level already, which is amazing for a player who's literally just turned 17, I think.
And Alex, what about you? Are there players that kind of stick out to you that you think complement Xavi's style?
So yeah, I mean, I think Gavi definitely does fit that mold perfectly. And he's really sick to watch, just quite plainly. Kind of almost, I know Aaron's kind of made this comparison before, but he kind of feels a bit like Iniesta played on the left just by virtue of how good he is at keeping possession, knowing also the width that he needs to keep, having that sort of relationship with Alba. So I see a lot of that. But personally, what's interested me more is not so much, I would say, the specific players, but just the fact that Xavi's actually brought them into the team so immediately. And actually, what to build on what Aaron was saying about how La Masia brings through these players that are trained so well in, you know, in JDP and knowing Jogo de Possession. I've messed that up, but you know what I'm trying to say. And where to situate themselves. I think that's kind of partly exactly how Xavi's kind of immediately brought through this tactical identity so clearly. I mean, personally, I really, really love Nico Gonzalez in the middle. I think he's been really, really impressive to me. And then even just interested, I've been very interested to see both Ilias Akhomach, I hope I'm not getting that wrong, and Abde Ezzalzouli, both playing on the right. I think it's just interesting because where Nico, I think you can see there's a lot of quality there. And specifically what he brings is he does bring those third man runs that I think we see a lot through this Xavi Barca side. And also he keeps that possession nice and tight in being able to circulate well, patiently, and being able to counter-press. So he kind of fits everything really, really well, and he's really good, right? But what I find most interesting is really what they're doing on the right. It is definitely, I think, the weakest side compared to what they're doing on the left with Alba and Gavi. But it's just so interesting to see him throwing on 17-year-old and a 19-year-old that we haven't really heard much about before. And I do think it is because they fit the system so well. Don't get me wrong, they're really, really good. But I think a big part of it is how well they fit that system, and that's...
What about Yusuf Demir, though? I know you're probably a big fan of his. Do you see him? Because he's played a little bit in the first team, but I haven't actually seen too much of him. I saw him in preseason a little more, I think, than actually during the regular season. But do you think this was like a step up really early where he's not going to be able necessarily... Because I know they didn't originally get him. He's on loan, I believe, and they have an option to buy.
Yeah.
Originally, he's like for Barca B. Do you see him eventually like slotting into this side? Because I love the way he plays. I just don't know how early he's going to join in.
I mean, in terms of quality, 100%. It's yeah. More what we expect Xavi to do. And maybe not so much just in terms of having an actual outlet. I think he's kind of choosing Gavi over Demir at the moment. It's a bit too samey in terms of... Not saying the same profiles, but in terms of what they kind of offer to Xavi in those positions out wide.
Yeah.
So I would say probably... Yeah, it's kind of between them at the moment, and he wants a bit more of an outlet out on the right, which is kind of why he's had like Ezzalzouli, who's kind of... or Abde, as they call him, who's really performed that role really well. So yeah, I think that's partly what's keeping him out, but I haven't seen enough of... Well, we haven't seen enough, frankly. He's what, 5 games in, to really know what he's going to do with Demir just yet.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. The way they use the right side is a bit different to what I expected. So I think they have a little bit of a weakness at right back. I'm not sure what's happening with Sergiño Dest's fitness, but basically in the first 3 games... against Espanyol, I believe it was Mingueza who played at right back, nominally a center back. And then
it was
Benfica. I think it was Mingueza. And then
yeah,
against Benfica, they played a back 3. And then against Villarreal, they played Eric Garcia at right back. And those are all nominally center backs, but they would drop into a back 3 and build up. And then you would see, I think it was 3 different players on the right side there. It was first it was Ilias, then it was Demir, and then it was Abdi. They kind of all play as kind of like a wing back in possession, where they really drop deep and push wide to form that option, and then you have you create options across the middle with the midfield 3 and Gavi coming inside, and you allow Alba to push on, basically looking at that right back weakness and then going, well, we have a right back weakness, but we have an extreme attacking strength in Jordi Alba, so let's get him higher up the pitch and then use our right winger to drop deep.
And not to interrupt,
it's really interesting that you mentioned that, because like I personally, and I mean, I feel like maybe I've been a fan of Dest a little more than, I promise it's not because he's American.
It's American. It's 100%.
No, I promise it's not. But no, but there's certain things. I just love his, like, I think he has all the tools to be a top attacking fullback.
Yeah.
And I think like one of the things especially that's pretty critical in this Xavi side from what I've seen is the use of the fullbacks, because they don't just use them to hold with a lot of times. They use them to kind of just do a lot of different fluid motions. Like the amount of times against Betis I saw overlap or underlap, and that was especially on that right-hand side when Ousmane Dembele came in, his connection and the kind of threat. He was just a menace that entire game as soon as he came in. You know, I know they lost 1-0, but He really was creating so much threat, and it's not just overlap, underlap, so that they get the ball and do something with it. You know, usually when they get the ball, they try to play those low cut back crosses into the box because they don't have bigger guys, you know, to do anything. But they create a lot of separation in space for a guy like Ousmane Dembele to really have a go at players in these 1v1 situations. And like, maybe now under Xavi, Dembele could really get the best out of Dembele by creating those situations more often, because I think everyone recognizes like this Dembele guy clearly has a lot of talent. Obviously he has his injury issues, but if the hope is maybe he can kind of like sort out, you know, he can stay healthy, sort out whatever kind of disciplinary issues has been kind of going on or whatever, which I don't think is too big of a deal, but like get that consistent game time in those kinds of scenarios, like I wonder how much of a player he can become, because it really fits in. Go on.
Yeah. I mean, I think the scenario that was created in that Betis match, and kind of related to the point we were making about the right back being a center back, I think that was kind of facilitated by Dest being on the pitch, because so what happened was, the difference was, so in the games prior to that, Barca built up with a back three and then a midfield three. There were some different orientations. Against Benfica, it was more like a pivot with Frankie and Busquets together, but then in the other games it was more like a midfield three, and they had that back three. But what they did against Betis instead was, when they built up from deep, Ter Stegen was the one who joined the back three. And then when they built up at the half line, Busquets was the one who joined it. I think you kind of lose the value of Busquets as a receiver in the midfield space, where he's so good at just like getting off that quick pass or beating the first line. But what you did get was, and I spoke to Kate about this, Kate's a friend of the pod as well, you get Dest high up the pitch, and then by getting Dest out wide, you can get your right winger higher. And then they have that kind of same interchange that you get on the left side that Barca had with Alba and Gavi. Mm-hmm. And I think Dest kind of likes to invert, is what Kate told me. And you get that because you still have that right winger who can provide the width. You get the right back who can join and make those combination plays and really hurt the opposition with the same kind of 1-2s that you get on the left side. Right, I'm not sure if the trade-off is worth it for what you get in build-up, but... Yeah, I thought it was really interesting because you got Dembele really high up the pitch, and he had an amazing cameo. Like, I love watching that.
Yeah. And when you try to play that kind of quicker tempo, I think that they're going to. I guess I'm just a sucker for attacking fullbacks and stuff, because, like, Jordi Alba, like you were mentioning, Alex, like those third man runner stuff, I remember seeing an example of when there was some sort of combo on the left side. I believe it was Busquets that played the ball over the top, and it was like there was a shout for a handball, and nothing ended up coming of it. But those kinds of combo plays is what like I love seeing, those kind of quick passing, high level, expansive teams do. So I think someone of those guys of those kind of profile are pretty key to a side like that. But I do agree with you, Aaron, that like, you do miss out then having Busquets drop deep and stuff. Sometimes you do miss out for those kind of quick bounce passes and stuff that he's so well known for. Alex, I do want to ask you more about some of these other young players in the... unless you have something to add on to that.
Before that, actually, I just wanted to speak about... You were speaking of third man...
yeah.
Sorry. Speaking of third man runs, I think just to get back to a bit more on what I kind of noticed from Xavi's tactics side... is what I've really, really enjoyed from his first match is how often he's kind of using Frankie as that runner from deep.
Oh, yeah.
Or Nico, as I mentioned earlier. I think that's been a big part of his game. And I think what we spoke about earlier is in terms of how they're kind of trying to kind of force their way through the middle or the half spaces and kind of or pull the players out wide, stretch the defense a bit, the width of the defense, and kind of create those sort of spaces for Frankie to come through. I think that's been a massive part of how Xavi's kind of had his team playing. I think in the Espanyol match alone, which was the first game, I think you saw about 3 or 4 times Frankie going over, even the one time it was nearly a goal-scoring opportunity. So yeah, I think those are one of the big things. In terms of young players, I don't know who you're interested in, but go for it.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, we already talked about Gabby, but I think there's just, like, a plethora, and even a few others, but there's, like, I think we're missing, like, the big hitters that have kind of already established themselves. I mean, everyone knows, like, Ansu Fati and Pedri are, like, some of the top youngsters in the absolute in the world, but I really want to touch on them, Nico a little bit as well, and Araujo. I think, like, all of those guys are, well, I mean, Araujo is, like, I think he's 22, so he's not as...
He's 22, yeah.
Yeah, so he's not as young, but he's... might be the best defender actually in the Barcelona side. Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I don't think he's like PK or even maybe like a Eric Garcia or whatever, like in terms of on the ball. But I mean, to come, you know, to be like playing for Barcelona, he's still quite a good player on the ball. But I think he's just kind of like a defensive powerhouse with like really good recovery ability, and he's actually got some very interesting box threat. I was looking at some of his numbers, and versus center backs, his non penalty goals per 90 is 0.12, which is actually the 92nd percentile, and his non-penalty XG is 0.08, which is 90th percentile as well against center back. So like, you know, he's really getting into these. I mean, don't get me wrong, he takes a high volume. His volumes shots total is 0.78 per 90, and that's the 86th percentile. But it shows that he's taking a lot of shots from good positions, and as a result, a good box threat, because he has a high non-penalty goals per 90 as well relative to other players in his position. So I think all that stuff's really interesting about Rojo. And Aaron, I see you kind of want to add on to that or mention something.
Yeah, so I mean, he's a good set piece threat, I think, and he's tall, so he's got that good aerial presence. But another thing is he's kind of a fascinating carrier out of the back. But I think going into the season, there was a lot of buzz around Barca saying that Araujo is actually their best defender. And I think they're actually going to have to sign someone to build around him. I think we were making a point earlier about Gerard Pique, and I don't actually think he's in this side by design. I think he's in this side by necessity, because they don't really have anyone else, especially when they're playing in that back three. I wanted to touch on Ansu Fati, actually. I don't think he's played under Xavi. I think he's been out, right, with some kind of injury.
Muscle injury. He's out until the end of December, I want to say.
Yeah, so I mean, I think...
Or maybe that's Pedri I'm getting confused with. It might have been... Yeah, Pedri's the one with out until the end
of
December.
Pedri needs a nice long holiday in a very warm country. But we'll talk about Fati for now. I think... Kind of tying in a couple points here, you know, we talked about Frankie making those kind of runs and becoming a third man runner and kind of fashioning, helping fashion chances for Barca. But I almost feel like they're kind of suffering from a lack of players who move in behind and around the defense. I see Memphis as a player who can do that, but I kind of like him as the player who tries to get on the ball. I think they're kind of missing that guy who's... They've been playing guys like Gavi in the front three, and they've been having their right winger go wide and drop off. And I think they're missing that guy who's going to make those runs in behind when Memphis drops and kind of capitalize on those spaces that occur in behind the defense line. And I know Alex made about how he kind of think... He posted a tweet about how he almost thinks Fati's reputation has risen quicker than it should have because of the fact that he can be that guy for Barca who runs in behind. So I was actually going to ask Alex, what do you think about the possibility of Fati coming into this side as the left winger in the near future?
So I'd be very interested to see that. I think that would also mean a lot for Demir potentially on the right. Because I think Xavi kind of likes that balance, right? Or even maybe Osmane could be a bit of both on the right. But yeah, to clarify, my tweet was sort of, I think it came off to a lot of people as hate for Fati, which it absolutely wasn't. I was just saying that the fact he's so good and that he's so necessary in a side that absolutely lacks anyone like him almost exaggerates or inflates his impact on the side beyond what it is. I sort of make the same points about Emile Smith Rowe, who's literally on my wall. So I'm a big fan. At Arsenal, when he came in versus Chelsea... at Christmas or Boxing Day, right to the end of the season. It's just the fact that we needed someone who could operate in those spaces made Emile's own impact bigger than it actually was.
The Bruno Fernandes
effect. Yeah, well... but yeah, I think what I wanted to actually kind of move on to... So I think Ansu sort of was definitely a big thing missing under later Koeman, I would imagine. Especially just knowing from how Koeman sort of has used his sides... liked using his sides for the Netherlands, who I follow. But I actually wanted to kind of speak about the one thing that I'm not decided on is I'm not really sure where Memphis fits in under Xavi. I'm a massive Memphis fan, and I think he's a fantastic player. But just as I've watched, of course, there's not a lot. I think the one place that Xavi really wants you to kind of be involved right at the end, from what I've seen so far from his strikers, from his team, is at striker, yeah. And that's sort of not totally Memphis's game, as kind of Aaron was pointing out. So I'm kind of interested in whether you guys think he's actually the striker that could find his way for Xavi there, or Like, what kind of striker do you guys actually think they go for?
I'm going to push this back to you, because I think you know more about Memphis than myself, and probably Michael, well, too. Watched a lot of Lyon and Netherlands. But what I am going to say is, the question I'm going to pose to you is kind of, I don't know if Memphis is theoretically the perfect striker for a Xavi team, but do you really think Barca have, like, the resources to be able to drop a player of that caliber at this point? Because he seemed, to me, he's probably their... one of their best three or four players at this exact moment in time.
I mean, I absolutely don't. I think this is sort of a longer term look at it, yeah, about how well Memphis fits in under Xavi, which is kind of why I'm asking the question about what kind of striker do we think, because I'm yet to be convinced, and maybe I'll be proven wrong, but I'm yet to be convinced that it's a perfect match there, right? I think Xavi prioritizes a lot of hold up and linking play and stuff a lot deeper, but at the end, he kind of almost wants a David Villa sort of ability to get in, to find those pockets and shoot for him, right? Which Memphis is much better at actually finding players in or factioning for himself, which is not necessarily what Xavi, yeah, wants. He doesn't actually want his center forward picking it up in and around the box and trying to create a shot. I think Mikey had some ideas for a striker that actually does fit that, because I'm not totally sure who actually fits.
Well, I don't have a specific striker in mind. I just know that the off-ball movement, rather than being more ball dominant, is a relevant factor, right? That like we were talking about, those cutback crosses and stuff, like, you need a box presence, I think. And it obviously, like, you're going to Barcelona, the player needs to be very technically talented. And Memphis, I think, is ideal in that sense, where he's a striker that is a technical talent, that is almost like a guy who can play as, like, a 10, but up top, right? You know, it's like that kind of thing, I think, is a given fundamental at Barcelona oftentimes. But I'm not really sure, because I look at this midfield too, right? And I look at this midfield with, like, even their issues with fitting, because they have so much creative talent now with the young guys they have coming through as well. Like, you mentioned Busquets and Frankie that have been staples, but, you know, we've mentioned Nico, we've mentioned Gabby, we've mentioned Pedri, we mentioned, so, and I don't really know what they're going to do. So I don't think it's necessary, like you were talking about, for a guy like Memphis to be in the team who also drops in crowds that kind of space a little more. I think it's more necessary for a guy to be off ball movement and box present. I don't know. Is that kind of the same kind of idea you were having, Alex, or do you disagree?
Yeah, it's sort of, no, it's 100% sort of what I'm seeing as well. I think Memphis also really likes, he still has that responsibility for the Netherlands a lot of the time, and he still has, or had that responsibility when he was with that at Lyon. He kind of likes to be the guy who kind of, everything goes, he's a really good focal point, right? But he's not a good outlet, which is sort of what I think Xavi really wants him to be, rather than the focal point necessarily, or rather than a link-up player.
I'm not sure I agree.
Go for it.
I think it's necessity. you're pairing him with wing combinations of like Gavi and some youngster who's dipping into the wing back areas. Like I keep saying, like I think you almost just need someone who's going to make those runs and get in behind, because if you don't, they're not going to score goals. Like, the game against Villarreal, the first goal, you know, the reason why that goal happens is because there's players swarming the box, and I don't feel like they've been doing that enough or getting into those good goal scoring positions. And I think having Memphis as the guy who's running in behind is really out of necessity to get in behind the opposition defense. But
what I want to know, Aaron, is, do you think then that, let's say Ansu comes back, do you think Memphis and Ansu, do you think Ansu basically becomes the left wing and Memphis stays at center forward?
I think that's a viable option. Like, the way I see it with Memphis is, like you guys said, he's a ball dominant creator. He's the guy who, you know, he can stay on the last line. He could probably hold up the ball. He can do some of the striker stuff, but what he ultimately wants a lot of the time is the freedom to drop off that last line, receive the ball, and make plays. And there's two ways to kind of make that work, right? You can play him off a striker who's going to make the runs in behind and have the striker movement and touch the ball 15 times a game and score a goal. Or you can do it the Liverpool style, which is have two wingers who are going to get in behind and kind of get into the box and be your high volume goal scorers. What I will say is, I think you have to build this team around Memphis at this stage. Like, I'm not seeing Barca going into the knockout stages of the Champions League or the Europa League, maybe, and, you know, playing, having Gavi and Nico running their creative output to beat these, like, big European heavyweights, you know? You have to build 100%. Memphis at this stage.
I mean, Yeah, to be fair, my question was more, I think, looking forward for Xavi, but I 100% agree.
He's one of your best players, you know?
Like, I mean, especially with...
Well, hold on. I think for the sake of time, we have to move on from Memphis. But it is definitely a very interesting talking point. I do want to discuss though, and I want this to feed into actually Barcelona kind of out of possession, because like I mentioned earlier, the midfield combinations they can come up with are actually pretty crazy now that they've added Nico and Gabi mainly to be able to play in those midfield positions. And there's a lot of different kind of options they can run with in that trio. Depending on what they want to do, which we understand they want to play a high pressing, quick tempo style. Alex, I want to ask you, is there certain things you've seen, which the way that they play out of possession, that you think those kinds of players would suit better? How do they get that best balance to be able to execute on the style they like?
So I think first I'll just kind of speak about what my impression of them out of possession is, just to go further on what I said earlier, and maybe the problems I've kind of seen. But I definitely do think, if I understand your question right, that they don't have the personnel that maybe Xavi really wants right now. What I will say is, so I really like their structure. In possession and out of possession, as I've said, I think I've said it like 3 times now, and I've told you guys in our WhatsApp group, I don't know how many times, that I've really, really like how clear their identity is. But I think that actually helps them out of possession, just how clear their structure and everybody's positional sense is, really helps with their counter pressing and how quickly they move and how quickly they swarm players. The problem is, I think we saw this in the Villarreal game, less so in the other games, but when it comes to the man marking, I still think that's maybe a bit basic compared to the I wouldn't say anything that Xavi's doing is particularly advanced, rather that it's very clear. But I think the man marking is a bit basic, and kind of Villarreal kind of grew into the match after the first 20 or so minutes of Barcelona dominating. They kind of figured out how to create these numerical advantages by playing with Barca's sort of man-marking system, and they kind of ended up shredding Barca a couple of times. So I think that's a definite problem that needs to be dealt with. I'm not sure if it's a long-term problem, because pressing takes time to work on, and I think the fact that it's so clear right now does give me encouragement. Then the other thing I will say, and this is what I think is probably their biggest problem right now, is they really struggle when they're put under pressure, a direct pressure in the box. I mean, we saw it against Espanyol, we saw it against Villarreal. Those are the two games that stay most clear in my mind. It's just when they started sending balls into the box, Barcelona didn't deal with it well. They got many shots off. They don't deal well from corners either. And even if we look at Chukwueze's goal, it came from, I think, Eric Garcia throwing in, if I'm correct. But basically a bad throw in, and then all Villarreal had to do is pretty lots of direct sort of passes that I think would have been dealt with a bit more maybe physicality or structure defensively. Chukwueze got a goal. So that would probably be my biggest problem, would be them out of possession right now. I think the man-marking system isn't doing it yet. And I do think that they struggle under direct pressure. The one thing I do really like, though, is it's early days, so yeah, it could really improve.
I like a lot of it. Oh, sorry, go on, Aaron. You got it.
Now, I was going to say, I think Alex read my notes, because the two biggest things I had were getting shredded in the counter press and struggling to defend in the box. So Benfica scored a goal that was disallowed on like a very, very marginal offside from a corner, where Barca kind of just didn't mark the receiver of the corner, and then they were allowed to get in. And I think they had a couple of struggles with set pieces and balls into the box in general over the few games. But I want to talk about the pressing point a bit more, because I think Villarreal is kind of a good team to expose the issues they had in their counter-pressing. I mean, it takes a while to implement a press. Everyone's been talking about this now with different teams appointing pressing coaches. Like, it takes a long time to implement an effective high press. But they've been leaving men open in their press, like leaving passing options that are kind of problematic. Like, against Villarreal, you have those deep playmakers like Etienne Capoue, Pau Torres, and there were a couple of occasions where they were able to just draw in the Barca press and then hit a ball over the top, and suddenly they were moving in almost like a transition where they had a man running at Barca's defense and other guys getting into the box on the attack. So they're going to have to clean up that press, and they're going to have to clean up their defending in the box when they're kind of receiving crosses.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think we've discussed quite a bit about both what we've seen from Xavi and what he likes to do, as well as some of the personnel. I kind of just wanted to get, like, a final overview of what we think the expectations are, what we think about him overall, and what we think moving forward, and just kind of brief stuff. Alex, if you want to start, and then we can move to Aaron.
So I'm not going to lie. I actually like what I've seen so far. I know that there are a lot of problems that they need to deal with. But yeah, I like how clear he's gone with an identity. I think that's convinced me a lot. How he's brought players in that serve his roles rather than trying to sort of, you know, push together like Coutinho and whoever to try to make something out of that. So I'm kind of confident. I'm not confident. I'd say I'm encouraged by early Xavi so far. And even to compare to the Al Sadd matches I kind of watched in preparation as well, I think they played really good football. It's a very classic sort of jogo de possession. I think I've messed it up twice now, but you know what I'm trying to say. So yeah, I think I'm quietly confident. I think they do have some big problems, basically, in defending.
And what about you, Aaron?
Oh, but sorry. Besides that, low-key, I'm happy. No, go for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to try and pronounce JDP in my bad French-Canadian accent, but I will say I have some concerns with their squad and how it actually kind of pans out to scoring a high amount of goals over a season, even if they kind of become better over time with more Xavi implementation. And I have more concerns with their defense. And like I said, Ronald Araujo is the only center back who I really have any sort of significant faith in over a season at a Champions League level club. They might not even be in the Champions League, so it's interesting to see there. I think this is the type of transition season you're beginning to see with some of the super clubs. They got to get into that top four. One thing I will say is, even if they struggle with implementation, under Koeman, by XG, they were the best team in La Liga, and before Xavi joined, they were still in the top three, and they're still in the top five. So they're pretty much a high-end Europa to low-end Champions League team at their worst. So I don't see them getting worse than they are with the players they have, as in worse than they were at the end of Koeman. So I think it's roads up, and they have to look at getting into the top four, staying in the Champions League, and then seeing what they can do in the summer with some of the financial constraints we've seen with Barca in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think for me, there's two main things that excite me the most. But there's caveats caveats mainly with the first one I'm going to say. I like Alex, I do think there's clear identity, and I do think I do personally really like some of the ideas Xavi employs. That being said, I think there's a difference between having the right ideas and being able to implement them well. And I think that's really where there's this kind of like differentiation sometime between like what a coach and an analyst might do. So I don't know if Xavi is necessarily going to be a great coach. Does he maybe have really interesting ideas then, and maybe the right ideas at times? Yes, I think so. Part of that could just be that the style of play appeals to me though. The other part though is that I do think, and you know, we've kind of beat this dead horse, the like, it's true that these players are truly like insane, some of them, like and the last one I just want to talk about when we sum this up, especially because I don't think we touched on him too much, was Nico Gonzalez, because I just think he's such an interesting guy. I think in terms of his, like, if I look at Nico Gonzalez, I think of like a Busquets, Rodri, or Fabinho type player, but he's not playing like that. He's playing like way more advanced. I just think that there's players like this that are just coming out of La Masia, like just being produced out of nowhere. And yeah. I do think it's a huge thing to be excited for the future, whether Xavi really delivers on these guys or not. So I do have high expectations at the least for their team because of the squad. Alex, I know you're about. What's that?
I'm finally understanding. No, I'm just saying I'm finally understanding why you're keeping on trying
I'm
to
so excited
redirect
by
it back
I
to
really am. I'm so excited Wait, by
you
them.
Just,
I don't
this,
know why.
Get like, this. No, no,
by
no.
Me.
Guys, Nico is in the 98th percentile for dribbles across central midfield.
I think he's like 6'2 as well. Like, I mean, like it's crazy.
He's got a big frame. He's
huge frame.
Off guys. And he goes on some really cool slaloming runs where he just kind of like you see guys like bouncing off him and
guys
actually,
like
he's really secure in possession and most of his progression comes through carries. So he's a really interesting player.
No, that's what guys like that who just like have this like a size and frame that doesn't really match. They have just an unparalleled level of athleticism. I think are just the most unique and interesting to watch too. But yeah, I didn't mean to like put the spotlight on Nico. Nico was just kind of a representation that I think these guys are just like. I don't even think Nico's the best of the bunch. Obviously, like you know, Fatih and Pedri are superstars. But like, it's just wild to me. I do have high expectations. I know we've been going on for a while. So for the sake of time, that is it for this section of the podcast. When we're back, we're going to be joined by our very first guest, Steven Ganavas, who's going to be talking us through the Serie A title race over in Italy. So please stay tuned for that and don't miss out. Thank you so much and have And we're back with the final section of this week's episode. In this section, we're going to be discussing one of the few but exciting title races going on in Europe's top five leagues. We're talking about the race for the Serie A title. And to help us further dissect this topic, we're extremely delighted to have on our first ever guest, the regista of Scouted Football himself, Steven Gavinas. Steven, how are you, mate?
Very, very good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm all right. Very, very excited to have you on. I know we're all super excited to have you to talk us through what seems to be a proper title race over in Italy. For those of you who don't know, Steven is part of Scouted Football, who creates some amazing content on youth football in the form of articles, a podcast as well, and most notably their beautiful handbooks, which they've actually just released their 12th edition of. So please be sure to check out all things Scouted if you're interested in that, and show them and Steven some love. Their Twitter handles are at Scouted Football, that's football with FTBL, and at Steven Scouted, and you can find both their Twitter handles in the description below. So, without further ado, I want to get right into the topic of discussion, but I actually want us to start today with a team that maybe isn't so involved in the title race for the Scudetto as much now as they may have been in previous years. Steven, I'm pretty sure that's a Juventus jersey. So I know obviously you're a supporter of Juventus. So I wanted to kind of come to you firstly to see your thoughts, basically on where you think it's gone wrong over the last few seasons, and how Juventus' dominance has unraveled a little bit, and what's been going on even a bit this season. If you want to touch on those things a little.
Yeah, I think it's gone wrong where kind of every big club goes wrong in a sense where the kind of strategy from top to bottom kind of just falls apart. And I think the club, started to like the smell of their own farts a little bit, and it got high on the supply of the free transfers. They started with the Pirlo and the Pogba free transfers. Khedira was a successful one as well, but then started to drift off, and it was Emre Can. And then Rabiot, Ramsey, ones that in the Ramsey case could have come off, but was a risk. And then Rabiot just hasn't been at the level. Emre Can, they were fortunate to be able to lump him off to Dortmund. But those kind of deals, signing players, you know, towards the upper end of the age tier, high wages as well, crippling the club's salary situation. The Ronaldo deal was quite financially crippling in that sense as well, and limited the club's ability, I think, to get in young players, and then looked for other options that could cook the books, essentially, as we're seeing now with the investigations, if people have been following what's been happening in the last week or so. So I think, it all kind of comes down to that. I think when you couple, you know, players in their late 20s, early 30s, really high wages, long contracts, and you know, a lack of youth coming through the club, which thankfully they're starting to rectify with deals like Chiesa, De Ligt, Kulusevski. It creates a problem, and now they're in the process really of regenerating the squad. And to be honest, I thought they were closer this year to being a contender than what they've proven so far. But yeah, there's a lot of problems in the squad right now.
Yeah, no, and it's actually been really interesting on one point, because you mentioned Juventus's business, right? And some of the stuff I've noticed over the years has kind of been like a mixed bag of things, where they've made some moves that were a little confusing, but like some moves that, as you mentioned previously, some of the free transfers they had brought on, and even signing Locatelli, right? Like, I'm a big fan of Locatelli. I think some of that is excellent transfer business. But then they've done the moves with Danilo. They've even brought back Bonucci and things of that sort. I think one of the things I've personally noticed about Juventus is that it seemed like there was kind of confusion sometimes with their business in terms of the way forward. So with that in mind, what would you say is the way forward for the team? And how much do you think their business has an influence on that?
Yeah, well, I think at one point they thought they were a lot better or closer to winning the Champions League than they were. When Ronaldo came, it was kind of like, we have to win now. And so everything kind of turned into, we need to sign players that will help us win the Champions League in the next 2 years, essentially, which has kind of been the club's obsession more than winning these league titles that they won consecutively. It's always been about winning the Champions League. So that kind of created a structural problem of just that win now mentality, and it kind of all blew up really in the last 2 years. So the club's really restructured its business, as I said, with those younger players coming in. But now it just takes time. With those bad contracts that they're tied to, you know, big money like Ramsey that they can't get off the books because no one wants to buy him. So it's just a process. And some of the deals like Locatelli's been coming and been a really, really important player. Obviously, Chiesa, Kulusevski, De Ligt, those kind of deals are really what's going to propel the club into the future. But in the meantime, it's really just kind of a bit of a, you know, wait and see approach, waiting for all these older players to kind of move on. Things like the Bonucci one, you can't understand because he'd been there, done that before, and he has been quite decent since his return. But it is some of those, yeah, more Ramsey, even the swap deal with Artur and Pjanic. As you said, the sending Cancelo out to bring back Danilo to do some fancy accounting tricks with Manchester City. And I think even the clubs realised that doing fancy accounting tricks has kind of come at the expense of on-field product. So it's something I think that they're starting to understand, but obviously we're seeing the effects of it on the pitch.
Yeah, actually, just to add to that, I think if you kind of look at all the business you guys have kind of done, it was, especially with the free transfers, I mean, it was really just looking for high-profile players on frees, regardless of how well they kind of fit into your midfield, which is kind of been watching your midfield this season, and apart from Locatelli, like, he's the only one really building or really creating anything. Rabiot and McKennie and everyone kind of seems just kind of pushed in together to kind of make something happen, and then even before even getting to the attack, it's kind of, it just doesn't seem like a functionally made team. So it will take a while to kind of work that through.
Well, especially when, you know, in Serie A, I look at some of the other like leading contending teams. They got very dynamic midfields that rapidly can progress the ball up the field. And Juventus don't have that. Locatelli's been really, really good. But without other options, you know, someone like Rabiot is more of kind of like a shuttler through midfield, but his passing game isn't very, you know, anything extraordinary. Artur is kind of like a good receiver in midfield, but again, he's kind of like a give and go guy. He's not really dynamic in any way. And then someone like Ramsey that could play that kind of role is always injured. So, and McKennie just lacks the technical quality to be a real difference maker in midfield. And we saw Peele losing more as a kind of like a free reign midfielder that tries to attack the box at every opportunity because he just doesn't, no one really trusts him to play deep. So yeah, it's the midfield has been a massive issue and is probably the key to the team's problems right now. It's kind of in the same vein as Man United. It's just that lack of ability to properly progress the ball through midfield and create like properly structured attacks.
I think it doesn't help either that you guys don't really have a proper attack either. I mean, Morata, I think, was a great choice to bring in. I know we've spoken about him before, but to bring in alongside Ronaldo and really helped his game. But now, when he's kind of leading it by himself, I just don't feel that there's as much of a sort of a focal point to build through. So I kind of feel like everything was just built for Ronaldo, including bringing Bonucci back, and now you guys are kind of going to be in 1 or 2 years of sort of like a, you know, outer space, floating, waiting for things to kind of fall together.
You're right, Murat. Yeah, I think you're right. Murat is functions much better playing off someone than being the guy. And we've kind of seen him have patches where he can play up front by himself, but it's always in like little spurts, but he can never really put that consistent goal scoring form together because he can't really hold up the ball very well. So I think you're right there. The club up front does lack a bit of a focal point, and they're kind of trying to use Chiesa as that, as the reference point up front. But yeah, it's not really working, and you can tell because the team just isn't scoring enough goals to really be competitive.
Do you think Keane and Morata?
I want us to move on to Napoli real quick, because they have had a pretty crazy season so far this year, especially when looking at their kind of defensive record. I wanted to actually ask you a little more about what you think about them so far this season, what's been or who has been key in their team for them to be leading the table so far.
I think the big difference maker that's come in is Anguissa, who's just so good. Just does so much, and he's so good. He always had the Koulibaly in defense, who's quality. Osimhen up front, or Mertens or Insigne, whoever in the past has rolled through up front for Napoli. But I think having someone in midfield that can just do a little bit of everything and at a really high standard has kind of been lacking just a little bit, even though I really like Fabian Ruiz. But Anguissa just brings another level of dynamism, I think.
I really like them as a pairing, actually.
Yeah, it's a nice little combo of kind of, especially the passing of Fabian, and then Anguissa that can just do a little bit of everything, and they've just been really fun. And Spalletti, I think, has just released the shackles a little bit from last season. I think that's been the key. But I still think they're a little light in terms of depth, and that's definitely going to be tested now with the injuries we've seen them sustain over the last couple of weeks. They've been really, really good this season.
100%.
Yeah, it was Osimhen, Koulibaly and Anguissa who are all injured, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So pretty much they're expecting to lose them for the African Cup of Nations, which was gonna be a little kink in the season in January. But now it looks like they won't really have Koulibaly or Osimhen until February-ish. And Anguissa will, I think, come back in a few weeks, but then leave for AFCON. So that is really going to test them. It's probably the spine of the team essentially gone for 2 months. Guys like Petagna and Dries Mertens at the ripe old age, I think, of 32 or 33, are going to have to step up and deliver for them. Because, with Inter kind of lurking in the shadows, ready to pounce at any moment, they can't really afford to drop too many points over the next 2 months.
You mentioned Osimhen there, who I know has been a really key player for Napoli this season. Looking at his stats, he was fourth for non-penalty expected goals per 90 among regular strikers playing minutes in Serie A this season. Now he's injured till at least January, and then he might go to the AFCON. So I know they've tried a few things to kind of deal with that absence, but what do you think they're likely to do moving forward?
I don't think that anyone trusts Andrea Petagna to replace the production of Osimhen. So I think the thing that they'll go with is Dries Mertens up front, because even though he's 32 or 33, I'm not quite sure exactly what it is, but he does have that production in him somewhere. We've seen it in the past. So I think they'll go that route. And I think it was semi-successful against Inter. They scored some really nice goals. But it's not Osimhen. He's been so dynamic this season. He's always looked good in Serie A, but he's always kind of struggled with injuries. And again, that's the thing that's kind of keeping him back. But when he's, in full flight, stretching the defense, I think is one of his best traits. Just the ability to occupy defenders and cause them problems and then create space for others. And then his ability to then score himself is obviously top class as well. So that's a massive, massive loss for them. And I think that's why Inter will kind of be, yeah, as I said, lurking in the shadows and looking to pounce whenever they can.
Just before I let Mikey move on, the one other thing I was thinking about watching them is just how well Spalletti actually has them pressing. And Osimhen's been a big part of that in terms of leading from the front. I'm actually wondering whether Dries Mertens will even be able to replicate that, because it seemed actually versus you guys, it was quite a big part of the second half how quickly they were beating you guys off the ball and being able to attack again. And Osimhen seemed a great proponent of being able to push Chiellini and Bonucci to pass forwards quicker than the midfield in Grisa would often come through. So do you guys actually think without Osimhen that they're even going to be able to sustain their current lead or be near in the title race by the time he comes back?
I personally don't think that they will win the title. And I've got a friend that supports Napoli, and when they kind of got off to the quick start this season, I just said, just you wait. I'm not worried about Napoli. It's always Inter. They're the ones that have, you know, the quality and then the depth of quality through their squad to sustain a title run. And obviously you never suspect the level of injuries that Napoli have had to come. But Osimhen out for 2 to 3 months is a massive blow. And as you said, it's the goal scoring, but yeah, the pressing is a really key part of it. Just his all round athleticism. Athleticism is like one of the elite level players in all of Europe. So it's hard to replace that with anyone. But Dries Mertens will come in. I think he's still mobile enough. He's obviously not going to give you Osimhen levels of pressing, but I think that the system will functionally remain fairly similar. But obviously there'll be little tinkerings here and there where Mertens will probably come a little bit deeper and send the wingers a little bit more forward to attack the box and create goals that way. It's a little bit more combination play and a little bit less directness that you get with Osimhen.
I don't want to move on to Inter just yet. I do want to talk about their best friends, AC Milan. So it seems actually that over the past few years, both have kind of tried to aggressively reestablish like the AC and Inter Milan of old, where they were consistently challenging for the title. And AC Milan maybe have not been successful in terms of silverware relative to Inter, considering Inter won the title last season under Conte, but they have had a pretty interesting squad building project over the recent years. So what do you think about their squad? And do you think they have the kind of talent and depth there? Like you mentioned, you don't believe Napoli had the depth. Do you believe they have both of those aspects to sustain a title challenge?
Yeah, so Milan's a little bit different to Inter, just from a purely... I think Inter still looked for more established players as part of their rebuild, whereas AC Milan have clearly gone very heavily towards younger players. And they've kind of put themselves in some difficulty with their failed squad building projects of years gone by. But the renaissance over the last two seasons has been really exciting. They've picked up some fantastic young players on some really, really good deals. I still think, just like it was last year, they're probably just a little bit too young to really sustain the title challenge for the full season. Like last year, they were top of the table halfway through the season, were looking really, really strong. They just about not lost a game, I think, for the entire calendar year, just about of 2020. But it is sustaining that push over the full season. And then they're another team like Napoli that will be affected by AFCON with Bennacer and Kessié heading off for the African Cup of Nations. So that will be a massive blow for their midfield as well, even though someone like Tonali has been a lot better this season than he was last season. So again, like Napoli, I think they're just a step off at the moment. They could still challenge, but I think I'd put them in the same boat.
Yeah, and let's say that the team kind of does mature to that standpoint. Do you think Piolo is the man for the job to take them to that title? Do you think he's capable? How far do you think they can get with him as manager?
Yeah, Pioli's evolved quite a lot over the last 3 or 4 years since he's been at Milan. He kind of came from his time at Fiorentina and he kind of had, I think he had a little bit of that dinosaur reputation, but now his AC Milan team are probably one of the most exciting teams to watch in Serie A. And going back to what we were talking about before, was they're one of the faster teams in terms of when they get the ball into their midfield, move it so quickly in that transition from defense to attack, with players like Brahim Diaz that have improved so much. So I think he's definitely shown the pedigree that he could challenge and win the title. But I think the squad just needs maybe a year or two, another one or two kind of key signings. Someone like Adli coming in, I think, could be a really big boost to them next season as well, just for a bit more midfield depth. But yeah, I think he's improved a lot, and he's definitely capable.
Yeah, and the last player I wanted to get your thoughts on, because he's just a lot of fun for me to watch, is Rafael Leao. I wanted to know, because I feel like this happens with a lot of players who are they have the skill set, what it seems to be a nine in the long run, but it's always uncertain whether they really develop that kind of movement or off-ball ability. Do you see Leao long-term staying in kind of like a wide forward-like role, or do you think it's possible for him to become like one of the elite nines in the world down the line?
It's a great question. I think he does. But I think he's the type of player that, I think the key issue is he just doesn't get himself into enough like really good goal scoring positions when he plays up front, and so I think Pioli feels safest and can get the best out of him, really definitely making the most of his athleticism out wide, and I think he's still playing really, really well, and his progression in the last three seasons has just been constantly on an upward trajectory. So I think they just kind of need to keep progressing as it's going, and as long as Ibra's there, keep getting him to learn as much as he can off someone like Ibra, and then hope, because he's got all the tools. I think he just really just, it's just a penalty box awareness, being in the right place at the right time kind of thing that he needs to build upon to become a really, really top level striker.
Yeah, I really like Leao and what I've seen of Milan, and I'm interested to see kind of how his development pans out, because there's a lot of debate around where he actually ends up in the front three. But I'm going to move on to their local rivals and current Serie A holders, Inter Milan, who, I mean, from watching them, superficially at least, they seem a lot like a side managed by Antonio Conte, who resigned last summer. And I know there are some differences, but to me, it looks like they might be experiencing some managerial hangover there. Could you comment on maybe some similarities and differences between Inter under Conte versus under Inzaghi?
Well, I think everything really is functionally pretty similar. Obviously, losing someone like Lukaku is going to be very difficult to replace, but Edin Dzeko's come in and has had, I think, people say second wind, but I think it's either the third, fourth, or fifth wind of his career so far. I think the really key loss is Hakimi, because that kind of production that he gave from right wing back last season was absolutely elite. But everything is still functionally pretty similar. I think they dropped a few points here and there at the start of the season, but I don't think that was a good reflection of what they are as a team. I still think that they're easily the strongest squad at the moment. They keeping things similar from what Conte was doing has meant that, you know, they really haven't had to have a bedding in period with Inzaghi. It's just, you know, click from the start of the season, they just go again in the same way. So yeah, for me, that they're by far the favorite for the title, and you know, they just need to kind of keep things the same. And if they just keep adding a couple of little bits and pieces here and there, like they did with Calhanoglu to replace Eriksen, even though he hasn't been fantastic, has filled a role. They need to re-sign Brozovic, but I think they're in for a period of sustained dominance if they can keep the players that they have now. Now that they've solved some issues with those two big sales this summer, and just keep things ticking along a la Conte, really.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers back up what you're saying. They have pretty much identical and actually slightly better expected goal metrics compared to last season. And key rivals like Atalanta and Juve, who were scoring well last season, have also fallen off a little bit. I know you've alluded a few times, both in the Napoli section and now, to the fact that Inter are probably your favorites for the Serie A title. But do you want to maybe talk about some things that could perhaps stop them? Like, I know you mentioned Brozovic. He seems like a really important player to me, and same with Lautaro. Maybe some other factors that could prevent Inter from taking that final step and repeating the title?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think Brozovic is really key because he unlocks other players. He, in the last two seasons or so, I think he's always a little bit of an enigma in the past, and could have really, really good games, could be really, really bad at times as well. But he's become just consistently so, so good at the base of midfield, and that allows players like Barella to excel and be free to go and seek the ball and be really aggressive defensively and offensively as well. I think as much as Lautaro is fantastic, I think something happening to Dzeko would be catastrophic, because he's kind of in the same way that Lukaku was, the fulcrum in attack that everything really works around and really gives the attack structure, whereas Lautaro's more of a someone that'll float around and do things and combine a little bit, but Dzeko's the one that gives everything the structure to work around. So I think, yeah, if he went down, that would be probably the one, and he's really hard for them to replace, so the one issue for them would, yeah, I think would be that.
Stephen, I'm actually interested in your thoughts on Lautaro, because, I mean, whenever I watch him, I think I see a good talent, but not nearly as, I don't know, I don't see the same kind of guy that I see when I see Osimhen in terms of the potential, maybe. I think he's definitely a good performer, but I don't know, obviously I don't watch nearly as much Serie A as you, for example, but I've never kind of seen it compared to the guys that he kind of gets.
I think Osimhen is a if not a better player now, definitely has much higher potential than Lautaro, but Lautaro is a real killer. As you said, he doesn't get a huge amount of touches. He doesn't kind of strike as like a technically excellent player or a guy that's has excellent combination play. But
kind of always puts his foot through it.
Yeah, he's got instinct and he's a bit of a mentality giant. So I think that definitely, even though I think that's less and less a part of the modern game, I still think, for certain players that can like really propel them from just being okay to being really, really good. And then, yeah, in the penalty box, he's an excellent finisher as well and scores a good range of like really different, but like some kind of like extraordinary finishes to pair with the simple tap-ins. So he's like Icardi, but a bit better. It's hard to, it's hard to explain it, because I think Icardi always weighed into down because he was such a... such a like basically a waste in possession. He didn't do anything except score tap-ins, whereas Lautaro can still hold like the Conte had the set play where he'd get the someone to play the ball into Martinez, and then Martinez would send Hakimi off on a run down the right flank, so he's still pretty intelligent in playing in that way. So he just has Icardi plus a few extra weapons that he can bring to the table that means he can function in a team rather than just being a
Definitely a much better on-ball player.
Yeah, well, I want to actually move on to the final team on our list, and probably a team that has kind of impressed everyone more particularly the past few seasons. Atalanta have really made a name for themselves under Gasperini in their like high-octane attacking system. Recently, though, there's been kind of some conversation around them bottling games or not really asserting as much defensive control in positions of superiority. And how true would you say that statement is? Because even for those that maybe don't watch the Serie A, but have watched the Champions League, we've seen that happen, right? With some of their matchups in the Champions League itself. How true does that ring to their performance so far in the Serie A this season?
Yeah, but yes, Atalanta have always kind of tended to bottle games every now and then. And I think that kind of comes with the way that they play. If you're going to throw numbers forward and be really aggressive, it's going to work a lot of the time. But every now and then you kind of going to embarrass yourself when you just don't quite get it perfectly right. But I think the results speak for themselves. Like, their squad's good, but it's not the best squad in Serie A, and they're constantly competing for the title, constantly in and around the top four. So they're there again this season. I don't think that they're going to win the title, but Gasperini continues to, you know, as players come in and out of the squad, a lot of the times you see these teams pop up. They've got a really good team for one season. Then the players get picked at and they go away. It kind of happened with Monaco when they had Mbappe and Bernardo Silva, all those guys. Once the team got picked away at, the coach couldn't really recreate the same system with different players. Whereas Gasperini, whoever comes in and out, the ball keeps rolling and the show keeps rolling on. So they've lost Romero, they've lost Papu Gomez in the past, who were key players. But yeah, they continue to just play the same attacking fun style, and it gets results. So yeah, they might drop a game here or two that they should win, but ultimately it's still super positive for them.
Yeah, and one of the things you mentioned, Papu Gomez and Romero, I wanted to ask specifically about those two. Actually, funny, you should mention. But how big of a loss? I mean, Papu Gomez was like a staple in their team, like even before I feel like they kind of like hit the stage in the Champions League a couple seasons ago. How big of a loss do you think those characters were for Atalanta? And do they do a good job, you would say, of replacing those kinds of talented players to keep up their system and the level of kind of quality within the squad?
I think the Papu Gomez one, they were happy enough to let him go because they know that they have Ilicic and Zapata and Muriel up front, who are three guys that just keep putting out elite level production, especially Muriel and Zapata in the last two seasons have been extraordinary. Romero is the more difficult one because I think he just fit the system so well as like a really aggressive center back, and he was learning a lot under Gasperini as well in terms of the attacking side of the ball, passing into midfield. But then they get a player like Koopmeiners that comes in and straight away he's been really impressive, and I think he's probably far more established. Well, not probably, he's definitely far more established as an on-ball player than Romero is, but probably just lacks a little bit of the athleticism that someone like Romero can bring to the table. But as I said, whoever comes in and out, they just continue to push forward in the same vein and are doing really well.
Yeah, no, and I love that you mentioned Muriel because, I mean, especially being into the analytics a little more so, you look at Muriel's numbers per 90 insane. Because this guy is quite literally a super sub. Like, I mean super in all the ways it could possibly mean. This guy just comes in and his numbers for the minutes he plays is pretty unreal. But I think, unfortunately, that seems to be all the time we have today to talk about the Serie A, and that kind of concludes everything for this week's episode. I want to say thank you so much, Stephen, for joining us today. It was a great pleasure to
have
you on.
Thank you very much. Been lovely. I always enjoy talking about the greatest league on the planet, so thank you for having me on.
No, of course, and we really appreciate the expertise you bring for us to kind of share with everyone. And of course, thank you so much to my good two friends, Alex and Aaron, for being on as well. Please be sure to drop a like if you enjoyed this episode, and please engage with us in the comments. We love to hear feedback for future episode ideas as well. Don't forget to subscribe to the Football Per 90 channel to keep up with all the future podcast episodes, and follow us on all of our socials at Football Per 90. Thank you for joining us, and have a good one.